Today we're going to extend the compensating wage differential model we talked about last time and look at what happens when some of the conditions or some of the assumptions of the model are violated. In particular, last time we talked about the hedonic pricing model of job risk. We showed that if workers have perfect information, if workers maximize utility, and if there's a sufficient level of worker mobility, then an optimal trade-off exists between the level of on-the-job risk and the level of wage offered at a variety of jobs. OSHA requirements, however, introduce something different into the mix. OSHA requirements establish work rules that are designed to improve the level of safety or to reduce the risk of injury in the workplace. For our purposes, it's probably best or it's probably simplest to assume that OSHA requirements effectively establish a maximum level of risk that is allowed at any job. Because since the requirements are designed to reduce risk, it's helpful to think of them in terms of establishing the maximum acceptable risk. Let's examine what the impacts of that will be. In this diagram, RMAX is a maximum acceptable level of risk that can be offered at a job when social requirements are introduced and are binding, and WMAX is the associated wage that would be is matched with that level of risk. Now, if we take an individual such as person A here, who faces a level of risk that lies below the maximum level of risk, we observe that when that individual maximizes utility subject to this wage risk offer curve, there is no effect on their optimal mix of wages and risk, that this individual faces a non-binding constraint. As long as the job is safer than the maximum level of risk that OSHA allows, essentially there is no effect on either the level of risk or the level of wages on the job. You can probably think of a variety of jobs where the job is safe enough so that OSHA requirements effectively have no substantial impact on the workplace. On the other hand, there are jobs such as construction jobs, many types of manufacturing, agricultural production, and so on, where OSHA requirements may introduce a more serious or more substantial effect on the level of risk that's allowed in the workplace. Let's look at what happens, though, for individuals who initially would prefer a level of risk or would choose a level of risk that exceeds the maximum allowed under OSHA. In this case, individual B would initially, in the absence of OSHA requirements, select a level of risk at R sub B and would choose a wage and would end up with a wage of WB. That's the combination of wages and risks that maximize this worker's utility given the wage risk offer curve that this person faces. If OSHA requirements are introduced, that level of risk is no longer allowed, and in a sense, the maximum level of risk, the highest point that can be used under this wage risk offer curve, would be a level of risk associated with RMAX. In a sense, now we move this individual from an unconstrained maximum to a constrained maximum, and the highest level of utility this person can achieve shifts to U1B. In other words, since a person cannot go beyond RMAX, that would be the highest level of utility achievable, given the constraint wage risk offer curve that essentially ends at R max and doesn't extend beyond that point. So this individual would have a safer job, would end up with a lower level of pay, but also would experience a reduction in the level of utility. This is essentially the major argument against OSHA. And opponents of OSHA essentially make this case, that if individuals are voluntarily selecting the mix of wages and risk that they find optimal under conditions, under the assumptions of this model, any sort of constraint placed on them will necessarily reduce the level of utility of some workers while not affecting others. That a constrained optimum will never be higher than an unconstrained optimum, and in some cases at least will be lower. So what happens basically is for individuals who already or who prefer to work at safer jobs, OSHA has no impact. For individuals who would prefer a higher level of the wage and a higher level and accept a higher level of risk to get that higher wage, those individuals end up losing utility and end up being less happy under OSHA. Supporters of OSHA, though, take a somewhat different view, surprisingly enough, and they argue that OSHA requirements can be justified using one of either two approaches or one of two arguments. The first argument that's often used is that workers may systematically underestimate the amount of risk that they face in the workplace. And secondly, there may be some externalities that are not taken into account when workers compare alternative combinations of wage of risk and wage rates. Let's examine each of those arguments in a bit more detail. If workers systematically underestimate the amount of risk that they face on the job, then their perceived level of risk will be lower than the actual level of risk at any given wage rate. That relationship is captured in this diagram appearing on the bottom of the screen. The actual relationship between wages and risk is given by the wage risk author curve on the right. The perceived relationship is essentially a horizontal shift of that curve to the left. Because we notice, for example, workers, I think it's fairly safe to assume, know how much they're being paid, but may not know the level of risk they're facing. So if a worker, for example, receives a wage of W0 and is actually facing a level of risk of R sub A, their actual risk, their perceived risk, R sub P, is likely to be lower than that. Now, there's two basic reasons why the perceived risk is likely, or why supporters of OSHA argue that the perceived level of risk is less than the actual level of risk. One reason is because when workers are asked firms about the level of risk they're likely to face on a job and so on, it's likely that firms might have an incentive to perhaps understate the true risk that the workers will face, that there's some degree of asymmetric information existing, that workers and firms don't have equal access to this information. A second reason why this sort of misperception may exist is because it's fairly well documented that most workers tend to believe that they're more careful than their fellow workers. For example, if a firm or if a prospective employee at a firm asks the manager or the supervisor or their prospective supervisor how safe the job is, it's quite possible, for example, that the supervisor might state that the job does have some risk of injury, but usually the injuries are caused when someone violates their work rules or when someone is not as careful as they could be. And it's not uncommon, perhaps, for management to blame injuries on workers who are not following prescribed safety procedures. And a prospective employee, when faced with such information, might very well think that perhaps they are much more careful than other people. Okay. And again, there's a fair amount of evidence suggesting that that type of systematic misperception of risk may exist. Now, given that workers face this perceived, or believe they face this perceived relationship given by the left, or the perceived the wage offer curve on the left in this diagram, when they maximize utility subject to their perceptions of this wage risk offer curve, they might find a point such as point P, or well, they would find some point such as point P to be optimal. At this point, they're achieving the highest level of utility they can, given their perception, at least, of the constraints they're facing. Now, in this case, the worker ends up with a wage of W, which they do know, we're assuming with certainty, but their perceived level of risk is R sub P, which is based on their perception of, again, the risk that they're facing. However, as just stated previously, the perceived level of risk is less than the actual risk. So the worker, while they may believe that they're at point P, is actually facing a combination of wage and risk at point A. Now, here's where things become perhaps a little bit more complex when you first see this. It may be a little difficult to imagine this. The worker believes that they're at point P and therefore is achieving a level of utility of U sub P. However, what happens is that the person is actually at point A. Now, point A is, or the U sub A is the indifference curve that goes through point A, which would be the level of utility this person would actually have if they knew the true level of risk that they're facing. However, since this person does not recognize the full risk or is not aware of the full risk being faced, this individual is very happy to be at point P, where they're getting a relatively high wage at what is believed, perhaps at least, to be a relatively low level of risk. If this person, though, somehow becomes aware of the actual risk associated with the job, he or she would then move to a combination of wages and risk that is optimal. That would be the point where, given the actual wage risk offer curve, if they become fully aware of that, their indifference curve is tangent to that actual wage risk offer curve. In this diagram, that occurs at point B. So once a person realizes that they're really at point A, they would realize that point A involves more risk than is optimal, and also a higher wage than is optimal. That the wage increase between point B and A is not large enough for this person to justify the additional risk. So this person would actually receive a higher level of utility by moving to a safer job at R sub B and accepting a lower wage at W prime. So once this person, if this person were to be informed of the risk or were to somehow become aware of the risk, would voluntarily move to a new, safer job. Well, one way of dealing with this is to provide perfect information, or to provide workers with more information. That process of providing such information is a fairly costly process. Some supporters of OSHA argue that it's easier, it's cheaper, it's more efficient, perhaps, instead of trying to provide workers with this information, which they may very well not believe, initially at least. It may be safer, or maybe easier, and you might achieve a larger gain, perhaps, by mandating a lower level of risk. In particular, for example, you could mandate that the maximum level of risk that workers would face would be R sub B. So the goal, perhaps, is to impose a maximum level of risk that is equivalent to the level of risk that a fully informed worker would accept if that worker had perfect information. Now, essentially, this argument is a fairly paternalistic argument, but it's one that is often made. As we noted in class, it's not uncommon, for example, for states to introduce seatbelt laws. It's not uncommon for laws requiring motorcycle helmets. And the same sort of trade-off is essentially introduced here. That one argument the state can do in both cases is to try to inform people of the advantages of wearing seatbelts or the advantages of wearing helmets while riding motorcycles. And then fully informed individuals could make the choices that are optimal for them given that full information. However, it's often argued that while that process in principle might be a nice ideal, it's very costly to try to provide such an education campaign. It's not always terribly effective and because it is difficult to convince people of the benefits of such things. However, it's often much easier simply to mandate the change and to move the individuals to a point which is believed to be in their own best interest. So it's, again, a bit of a paternalistic argument that suggests that perhaps OSHA is better able to judge what a fully informed individual would prefer as compared to what individuals themselves voluntarily select. And the argument is that's because the workers themselves don't have access to enough information, and it's relatively costly to provide such information, and therefore the best thing to do is to force them to behave in their own best interest. However, no matter what you do here, the individual after the change is going to be less happy than they believed they were. Because remember, at point P, they were living in a state of ignorant bliss, basically, that they were getting relatively high wages at what they believed was a safe job. Once workers realize that the job is not as safe, they end up with a lower level of utility. If they stay at the same job, they realize that they're really at point A, at the utility level use of A. If they decide to move to or are able to move to a new safer job, they move to a point such as B, which while it's better than point A, which is where they actually were before, they won't feel that way because they're really moving to a level of utility which is less than where they thought they were before. The other argument, again, as noted before, is that injuries do result in some externalities. The first type of externality is that when someone's injured on the job, there are negative externalities that result for family members who might be harmed if someone were killed or injured on the job. If individuals care about this worker, while the worker may come up with an optimal balance between wages and job risk on their own, or basically they may weigh their own benefits and costs associated with accepting a more risky job and find that it is optimal for them to do so, those workers do not take into account the external costs that that choice might impose upon others. And in such a situation, they might accept a level of risk, well, they would accept a level of risk that would exceed the socially optimal level in that case. The other reason, which is quite similar, well, it's essentially an externality argument, but it's also essentially a form of moral hazard argument, is that worker compensation programs, disability insurance programs, also results in a similar problem in that once workers are insured against the financial effects, or at least partly insured against the financial effects of a disabling injury, the cost to them of being injured is substantially less than the cost to society. So essentially what happens is, in either case, some of the costs are borne by others, either because there are external costs where family members who care about the individual may be harmed if an injury were to occur, or because society as a whole is essentially sharing the cost of the injury through these insurance programs. In both cases, you'd end up with individuals selecting more risk than is optimal from society's standpoint.